have one case on our docket this afternoon, an original proceeding, N. Ray Frank Kent. If the clerk will please announce counsel in their time.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Ruotolo to argue for relator, and Mr. Timothy Shabonic to argue for real party and interest.
Okay. Thank you. Now, will you tell me how to pronounce your name so
sure.
I can do it correctly?
It's pronounced Ruotolo.
Ruotolo.
If you pronounce all the vowels, it should
That's
work.
That's perfect. I it go by. Is that an Italian name?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Well, welcome to our court.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to come over here. I've been here before and always treat it well. Are we ready to go? There's the green light. May it please the court. I want to get to the two questions that the court had sent to us when it set this for an oral argument. I think those should decide this case quite easily and quite quickly, I would think. The one question is whether Mr. Garcia was an at-will employee of Frank Kent. The other question, if so, what effect does that have on whether he rebutted the presumption that he knowingly and willingly executed the jury waiver? First question, I think, is real simple, and the second one is, too, as far as I could tell from the additional research that I did do since we got the letter from the court. The answer to the first question is yes, he was an at-will employee. The record shows that he was an at-will employee at three different places. If you look at the jury waiver in and of itself, it states he's an at-will employee. The only way he's not going to be an at-will employee if there's a written agreement to the contrary. And you look in the record, there's two other spots in the record. Mr. Garcia's response to my motion to strike, as well as his affidavit, he admits there was no written agreement. And I'm pretty sure when opposing counsel gets up, they're going to admit that too. That gets us to the next question. What effect does the fact that Mr. Garcia was an at-will employee have on the presumption that he knowingly and willingly executed the jury waiver? And I think it has a big effect. What they've alleged, and I think it was for the first time in this appeal, is coercion. I looked up the elements of coercion. The very first element is that Frank Kent does not have a legal right to discharge him. And when I did some research, and I apologize to the court that we didn't get this to them sooner, maybe the court already has it, but since I did get the notice, I did some additional research and found the case in Ray Halliburton, which states that an employer has the legal right to make such a demand on its employee. What that case involved, a 30-year-old employee, the company Halliburton went to him with an arbitration plan. They said, here's an arbitration plan. All of our employees, if you want to still work with us, you're going to have to accept this. The employee continued working for them, so under what they already told him, he did accept the arbitration provision. As time went on, of course, a dispute arose, and he sued them for both age and race discrimination. Similar to this case, we have an age discrimination claim, and an employee 30 years or so employed. The employer, Halliburton, moved to compel arbitration. The district court denied it. It came up to the Court of Appeals. They denied it. Then it went to the Supreme Court. One of the arguments the employee made to the Texas Supreme Court was that that arbitration plan was unconscionable. And the reason he argued it was unconscionable was because Halliburton came to him and said, here, take it or leave it. You either are going to be bound by this and continue working, or you're not going to work here anymore. That's almost the same exact facts that they're alleging in this case, where they're saying that my client, Frank Kent, came to Mr. Garcia with a waiver, mutual waiver of jury trial, and said that when he asked her whether he had a choice of signing it or not, and she said, no, you do not, something, words to that effect. So it's basically about the same. The Supreme Court said that that's all right. An employer can do that. An employer in an at-will situation can go to its employees and provide them, in that case, with an arbitration provision, which, as we all know, waives the right to jury trial. And in this case, the waiver of right to jury trial is not even as harsh as a waiver of arbitration, because arbitration, you're stuck with it. At least in a waiver of jury trial, we have a judge and we have a right to appeal, and you have, I think, additional procedural safeguards. But the Supreme Court said, and I'm going to read some quotes, that an employer may make precisely such a take-it-or-leave-it offer to its at-will employees. Because an employer has a general right under Texas law to discharge an at-will employee, it cannot be unconscionable without more, merely to premise continued employment on acceptance of a new or additional employment terms. That's exactly what we have here. If you substitute their argument coercion for unconscionable, I think it applies. There's a federal court case, and again, I did not cite it to the court, and I apologize. And if you need that cite to the Halliburton case, I forgot to give it. It's 80 Southwest 3rd 566. I do have copies of that case if the court would like it.
You can leave them with our clerk.
Okay, thank you. There's another case, a federal court case that came out of Dallas from Judge Lynn and was appealed to the Fifth Circuit, the Carter versus Countrywide case. And in that case, it was, again, an arbitration case, and they argued that I was coerced. They actually used that same argument they're using here, that the employee was coerced into signing it. This is a case where he actually signed an arbitration agreement. And he argued that the court should not enforce it because I was coerced into signing it because they said either sign it or you're fired, basically. The court said no. Texas law does not provide that, and they cited the Halliburton case and held that the employer had the legal right to do that, so there was no coercion, and they enforced the waiver.
Ask a question. Is proof of coercion the same thing as proving it was involuntarily signed?
I think coercion has got to be more than that. As I understand the term, unfortunately, none of the cases really define it. It's just out there. It seems to be a subset of duress. And the one definition I did find of coercion is economic coercion, and it's got five different elements. And the biggest one is that the employer did not have the legal right to do what it was threatening to do, and in this case, they did. And then they also, in order to prove coercion, that's pretty hard to do. You actually have to offer proof that it took away your free will, and that if there was an imminent threat, and that you also had no means of protection. Well, in this case, there's Mr. Garcia's affidavit doesn't have anything in there that it overcame his free will. I don't think there's any evidence of an imminent threat, because an imminent threat is sign it or you're out of here right now. His affidavit doesn't state that. And his affidavit doesn't state that he had no means of protecting himself. He believed, that's the language he uses, that he didn't have time to ask for more time and to go get an attorney to look at it. But that was just his thoughts. Nobody told him, you're here, you sign this, or you're out of here. But even if they did, that one element under the Halliburton case, and then it's followed by Countrywide, says that Frank Kent had the right to do that. So the coercion argument is out the window. And I think coercion's harder to prove than anything else. And so they haven't done that. And when you look at his affidavit, there's nothing in there that rebuts the presumption that he knowingly and voluntarily executed the agreement. If a jury waiver is conspicuous, it's presumed that it was knowingly and voluntarily entered into. They admit it was conspicuous in their response in the lower court. And just by looking at it, it's conspicuous. It's all in bold letters, and it's very easy to read. When Mr. Garcia filed his affidavit, quite frankly, he did not rebut that presumption. He actually supported it because he proved that he knew how to read and write and that he had time to look at the document. It was handed to him. He threw it under the desk. Someone came back later, so he had time to look at it and to reflect. He didn't do anything about it, of course. And he also, in his affidavit, states that he didn't like the language in it, so that proves he read it. So quite frankly, I think his own affidavit supports the presumption, and he didn't rebut the presumption. So that's what this case is about, and I think the court gets it, and I'm glad that I got that letter from you and did additional research on it, and I apologize for not providing that sooner. But I think that controls, and since it is controlling, then I believe the court should order the lower court to vacate its order, denying my motion to strike jury demand, and then ordering that the jury demand be stricken.
Mr. Otolo, what's the site of the Carter against Countrywide case?
That site is 362F3D294, and it's a Fifth Circuit case. And I do have copies of that, too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chavon.
May it please the court. My name is Tim Chivonik, and together with David Fielding, we represent the real party in interest, Tony Garcia, who I'll refer to as Garcia today. This court recently, in a memorandum opinion, acknowledged the distinction between a mandatory arbitration provision and a waiver of jury trial in the Pharmacy 2 case. That distinction is critical here. Why Frank Kent chose a jury waiver agreement as opposed to a mandatory arbitration provision, we don't know. But clearly they made that differentiation as the jury waiver reflects. That, in Garcia's point of view, is dispositive of the merits of this mandamus. First and foremost, our argument will be threefold. Number one, that there is a distinction between arbitration, mandatory arbitration provisions, and waiver of jury agreements. To understand the argument, are essentially nine core cases from the United States Supreme Court to the Texas Supreme Court to the courts of appeals. Secondly, the jury waiver cases that the Texas Supreme Court has promulgated over the last decade or so are distinct in their rationale from the arbitration decisions. And lastly, what is the basis of the distinction between mandatory arbitration provisions and jury waiver agreements? Let's start with the third first. Why the distinction? Mandatory arbitration suddenly popped up in the 1960s with the Federal Arbitration Act. The United States Supreme Court embraced these new mandatory arbitration agreements because the Federal Arbitration Act mandated that the court conduct a liberal interpretation of these arbitration agreements and to enforce them where possible. So there's this mandatory liberal construction in favor of arbitration, of mandatory arbitration provisions. If you read those cases, Prima Paint and Shirk, one a 1967 case, one a 1974 case, they talk about the need to bring arbitration contracts up to being ordinary contracts as opposed to unfavored in the law. And Prima Paint and Shirk do that. They were both non-employment cases. I'll try to make a distinction. Garcia will make a distinction for the court today, the difference between what was an employment case and what was a non-employment case, because that differentiation is important. Okay, that's the distinction with regard to arbitration, the attempt and the requirement. And Texas now has an Arbitration Act. And they've adopted that same rationale, that we favor arbitration agreements, mandatory arbitration agreements. On the contrary, the right to trial by jury is a right of constitutional dimension. And there's a wealth of authority in the United States Supreme Court for the proposition that every reasonable presumption against a waiver of a right to trial by jury shall be indulged. So the rationale of the competing provisions, arbitration versus jury waiver, are substantial. They are distinct. And you see that reflected in the decisions that the Texas Supreme Court has rendered. They rightly cite Halliburton. Recently, the 24R, In Re 24R, which is a June 2010 decision, follows Halliburton. It's an arbitration case. It is an employment case. Age employment case, and it basically recodifies the finding in Halliburton. That is, that you can coerce an employee who sues you for age discrimination to a mandatory arbitration. I think that is basically what Mr. Ruotolo just argued, that you can do that in an arbitration case. Next, if you go back to the history of arbitration following the United States Supreme Court's decisions in Prima Paint and Shirk, you find the Gilmer case, and the Rent-A-Center case. Rent-A-Center is a June 2010 opinion. Gilmer is a 1991 opinion. Those were employment cases enforcing mandatory arbitration provisions. But what they both said, if you look at the decision was enforcing the mandatory arbitration provisions, but both of them acknowledged that duress might be a defense to the enforceability of those arbitration provisions. I don't believe that Frank Kent can cite a United States Supreme Court case that says in an employment case, you can coerce a mandatory arbitration provision. We have that in the Texas Supreme Court with Halliburton and the In Re 24R. But I don't believe there is such a case at the United States Supreme Court level. So I think that's still, Garcia would argue, that's still an open question, even with regard to mandatory arbitration provisions. Now let's talk about jury waiver agreements. Three cases the court knows needs an understanding of: Bank of America, General Electric, and Prudential. It's critical to understand in those three jury waiver cases that each one of them, at various points of their decision, acknowledge duress and coercion as an element that could vitiate the agreement. Unlike Halliburton, unlike In Re 24R, and that was an October 2010 case, by the way, not a June. I misstated that. But those cases stand for the proposition that if you read them, 24R, Halliburton, they don't talk about coercion, except in the sense that you can say take it or leave it. And if I heard Mr. Ruotolo say, that's what Frank Kent said here. They're not contesting that Mr. Garcia was presented and said, you have no choice. You have to sign this. So what do Prudential probably has the most expansive discussion of the Supreme Court's decisions in Prima Paint and Shirk. And Prudential says, with regard to the real party in interest, ICP argues that if contractual jury waivers are permitted, some parties will attempt to take unfair advantage of others, using bargaining position sophistication or other leverage to extract waivers from the reluctant or unwitting. We agree, of course, that agreements made in such circumstances cannot be enforced. As we have said in another context, a waiver of constitutional rights must be voluntary. Now, that was a non-employment case. Prudential was. All three of the jury waiver cases are non-employment cases. So when that issue hits the Supreme Court, as we indicated in our briefing, it's pending. It'll be a question of first impression in an employment context, whether or not you can coerce the signature on a jury waiver agreement. But Prudential, Bank of America, and General Electric all acknowledge coercion and the coercion exemption that is noted in our original briefing with regard to the citation of the Prima Paint and the Shirk decisions.
But aren't we going to have a problem anytime anyone alleges that the coercion or duress is the potential loss of the employment, and that just butts heads with the employment at will principle that we have in this state?
Your Honor, there's a collision course in Garcia's view between Halliburton on the one hand and the United States Supreme Court decisions in Prima Paint, Shirk, that are embraced by Prudential. In other words, that head-on collision is going to occur down in Austin first, seems to Garcia, because you can't acknowledge the Prima Paint and the Shirk history and the acknowledgement that voluntariness is key to elevating these agreements to enforceability, as with all contracts. You have to be voluntary. And so that head-on collision between the at-will doctrine, as the court's questions duly point out, is coming. Because I don't, again, Garcia would contend that the language of the Supreme Court cases and of Bank of America, Prudential, and General Electric embrace the voluntariness requirement and the coercion exception to enforcement. And again, Garcia contends that the jury is still out with regard to coercive mandatory arbitration agreements. So, and it's understandable, particularly in the employment context. Garcia is not saying that Frank Kent didn't have the right to fire him. It's an at-will state. They had a right to fire him. What Garcia is saying is that they did not have the right to coerce him to sign a jury waiver agreement. As has been off-stated, you can fire an employee in this state for bad breath. However, the right to bad breath is not codified in the Constitution, nor is it codified in multiple United States Supreme Court cases and multiple Texas Supreme Court cases. So what Frank Kent wants to tell the court today is Halliburton, an arbitration employment case, is dispositive of this jury waiver agreement case. And the lines of authority, as you read these cases, you see that it's not dispositive, or you have to ignore wide swaths of the rationale in Prima Paint, Shirk, Prudential, General Electric, and Bank of America. So the next issue then becomes, obviously, if just the existence of a signed agreement is conclusive on voluntariness, why have the courts gone to such great length to talk about presumptions and rebuttable presumptions? In other words, if it's conclusive on the issue, why has the Texas Supreme Court and why has this court embraced the burden shifting to move forward with rebuttable presumptions and that sort? If a signed agreement is conclusive, always, I've got a signed agreement, it's conclusive. That's not the analysis that this court has employed, and that's not the analysis that the Texas Supreme Court has employed. So it, according to Garcia, is not conclusive on this case. In fact, the lack of voluntariness is unrebutted in this record. Frank Kent has not provided any affidavit, any testimony suggesting that Mr. Garcia had a choice. Mr. Garcia said that they presented it to me, and you have to sign this. You have no choice. That's not been presented, rebutted. Garcia has a complete lack of experience with matters like a ninth grade education. If you look at the terms of the jury waiver agreement, I think it's inferable that that was prepared by counsel or at least a very sophisticated employer. And so in the analysis of the types of factors that this court has recognized with regard to voluntariness, Garcia's affidavit stands unrebutted, uncontroverted. And at the end of the day, if this court did not want to be part of the head-on collision that's coming, that failure to controvert the fact that this was not voluntary could be dispositive of this court's determination of the merits of the mandamus. You're asking, does this court have
logic in terms of the fact that if the court accepts that voluntariness and the issue of coercion should apply to a jury waiver, then isn't that a carving out of an exception to the employment at will doctrine in Texas?
At the end of the day, I think that's true.
Okay.
But it would be based on United States Supreme Court authority and Texas Supreme Court authority. It wouldn't be a carving out of whole cloth. It would be based, in fact, in the rationale of the decisions that have already been handed down.
I was thinking you said that the Bank of America, General Electric, and Prudential decisions were the Supreme Court decisions dealing with the issue of voluntariness in terms of jury waiver do not deal with the employment circumstances.
That's absolutely true.
So there wouldn't be in any of those cases a employment at will issue.
That's true, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Chivonik. Mr. Ruotolo, rebuttal.
I'm moving as fast as I can.
I'm not quite too sure why we're bringing the U.S. Supreme Court into this. This is just state law. It's Texas Commission on Human Rights claim. They have not alleged any federal claim. If they did, we'd be in the federal court because I would have removed it real quick. The Prudential case recognized the argument that was being made here today that there's a big distinction between arbitration and jury waivers, and they said there is no distinction. We're treating them the same. And to me, as I already mentioned, he's given more procedural safeguards by just waiving a jury trial than if we went to arbitration. It's a lot cheaper. We get a judge, and you get the right to appeal. And quite frankly, I think it's the way to go. And that's what I think our Supreme Court has indicated as well. The real issue is, did he rebut a presumption? I'm not arguing you can't rebut a presumption with coercion. If they coerced him, then they could rebut it. But they haven't presented any evidence of coercion because they can't meet the first element. The first element is that Frank Kent did not have the legal right to tell him that if you don't sign this, we're going to discharge you. But Frank Kent had the legal right to do that. It's case law, it's Halliburton, it's been followed by the Fifth Circuit, which also indicates that federal law will probably also apply. That's really all it is. Did they rebut the presumption? And you just have to look at the affidavit, and it's clear that he did not. And we won't be getting into whether we're creating a cause of action, a new exception to the at-will doctrine. I don't think we want to go there. And it's just pure and simple, what does an employee have to do to rebut the presumption? And if you allow this decision to stand, then all he has to do is file an affidavit saying that they told me they were going to fire me unless I signed. That's just not enough. And that issue is exactly in front of the Supreme Court in another Frank Kent case, which is up there right now, and the briefings on the merits are going forward.
So your position is your client didn't have to rebut Garcia's affidavit because there wasn't enough there.
Right. There was nothing to rebut. And in fact, it's my position. His affidavit helped me. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing today on this rather short schedule. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Your case is submitted, and you all are excused. We'll adjourn court now.
Okay.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.
These two clerks. Should I give these cases?